to Australian Politics Live, the podcast. We have had a couple of weeks hiatus with being on a couple of days leave or off on assignment, but we're back in our normal alignment now. I'm Catherine Murphy, as I so often am, a political editor of Guardian Australia. And what I've put together for you this week is two meaty episodes about foreign policy, because I thought there were two major things going on in the world at the moment that listeners would be paying close attention to. The first is the crisis evolving around North Korea and its bellicose threats against the region and the US response to that crisis. So the first episode is a conversation about North Korea, which is the one that you're going to hear shortly. And then in a couple of days' time, we'll also give you a second instalment, which is basically a conversation about the first 100 days of Donald Trump as the US president. So let's just kick off into episode one. I am joined for this conversation by a lovely fellow by the name of Professor John Blaxland, who is the head of the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the ANU. We're very fortunate in Canberra to have a whole bunch of experts on tap a lot of the time, and John is certainly one of those. He's the author of a number of books, including most recently The Official History of ASIO, which some listeners may have caught up with. That's a very fascinating read. In this conversation, we're going to think about North Korea, the possible permutations of nuclear annihilation. Yes, I'm sorry, it is going to get a little bit depressing, and work out how this particular confrontation will work through over the next little bit between the US and North Korea. It's a very interesting conversation. So sit down, put your feet up. Here it comes.
Thanks for having me on the program, Catherine.
So let's just start with the easy question. What are the risks of all-out nuclear conflict in this very high-stakes transaction we're seeing with North Korea at the moment? First question, nuclear annihilation. Let's start there.
I think we're probably about as close to nuclear weapons being used in anger as we've been since 1945. There have been a couple of instances in the past where we've come back close. Most of those have been during the Cold War, during the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, and 1983 during Exercise Able Archer. Which is now well documented about the misunderstanding between the Soviet Union and the Americans about an exercise in Western Europe. What we face today, though, is rhetoric about the use of nuclear weapons that is as escalatory as can be recalled. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we face a real risk. Now, I think both sides, both the North Koreans under Kim Jong-un and the Americans under Donald Trump, are rational actors, but they're rational actors with degree of paranoia on the North Korean case.
I was going to say, I like your optimism about both being rational actors.
Rational to a point, rational within their own frame of reference. So with Kim Jong-un, his rationality is within the context of a deep-set paranoia that stretches back to the Korean War, when North Korea was essentially devastated by American bombing. And the rhetoric arising from that war has resonated and reverberated in North Korea ever since for a variety of reasons. But the North Korean state is, as you know, a fairly closed system, and the messages are controlled. And they are about the hostility of the United States, primarily of past misdeeds in their estimation, and therefore basing North Korean actions on seeking to prevent a recurrence of those American purported atrocities. And therefore, within that frame of reference, it all makes sense to the North Korean regime. And it makes sense to threaten the use of nuclear weapons. And as they look outside to see what's happened in the past few years, when we look at what happened in Libya, and this is something the Russians see as well, the Russians gave UN Security Council blessing to intervention in Libya. that essentially went beyond that mandate and saw Gaddafi overthrown and eventually killed. Similarly, in Syria, the actions there have only given greater hope and confidence to Kim Jong-un that going down the nuclear weapons path is the path of safety for the North Korean government and the North Korean people. So that is the internal logic that makes the path that they're taking make sense. And the threatening of violence is one that has worked for them for the last 60 plus years. And that's the threat of violence coupled with occasional ventures into the violent space, shooting down of aircraft in the late 1960s, capturing American warships, capturing occasional people near the demilitarized zone, executing people, and threatening retaliation and demonstrating the capability to conduct that retaliation. This is the thing that really makes the situation so scary, is that while the North Koreans have for quite some time had the ability to strike and cause massive damage to the Republic of Korea, particularly with their massed artillery and missile systems, that is changing because of the nuclear weapons part of the equation. And that's essentially what's pushing, I think, the Trump administration to argue for a change of course.
Yeah, because the end of strategic patience or whatever Trump's formulation
strategic
was.
Patience, according to the rhetoric, isn't working, hasn't worked, needs to be put aside. And on one level, that's understandable. You know, the miniaturization of the nuclear weapons capability does seem to be in train. The development of the multi-phased solid fuel intercontinental ballistic missile capability is in train, and pundits by and large reckon that that is something that is 2 to 4 years away from completion. So when you converge the two technologies, the nuclear weapons, the miniaturization of nuclear weapons capability, and the nuclear intercontinental ballistic missile capability, you have a potential existential challenge, which didn't exist before.
Well, you're in deeply scary territory. And Australia, John, do you think that that's serious or just posturing?
When it comes to Australia, it's very much posturing. The capability simply does not exist today to strike Australia from North Korea. The capability does, however, exist for North Korea to do the kind of misdeeds that were carried out in Malaysia against its own citizens. So the hostage taking, the execution, accidental death, the purported accidental death of people could happen. Now, I think that's highly unlikely, but it is possible. We've seen in the past the North Koreans basically conduct terrorist acts in Burma against South Korean diplomats. It's conceivable they could attempt something like that against Australian diplomats in the neighbourhood. It's not beyond the realm of possibility because they have a track record
of
extreme behaviour like this. And it is this extreme behaviour that has intimidated everybody else from encroaching on that autarkic state's extraordinary space that is, from space looks black.
Yes, well, quite, exactly. Is there any risk? I know you observed a moment ago that both of these characters are rational actors, but is there any risk that Donald Trump could think a preemptive strike was a good idea? Obviously, we've seen the rhetoric from the US administration ratchet up, although not so much from Trump himself in recent times. But is there any universe where Donald Trump might think a preemptive strike was a good idea?
Unfortunately, there is. It's a very scary thought.
Well,
it's one that I think is tempered by the knowledge that he has thankfully surrounded himself with some reasonably level-headed individuals in the national security space. H.R. McMaster, Jim Mattis, these are rational actors who have experienced war, know what the consequences of violence are and the potential for retaliation are, and for the potential of a plan unraveling are. They're fully cognizant of that. And while Donald Trump conceivably could in a moment of effusive reaction to a nuclear explosion, firing of a ballistic missile, stepping over the DMZ, conceivably could call for action. He thankfully is surrounded by a number of people who would probably get him to exercise some restraint. That is...
I'm seeing a but on John's face, yeah, just by the way.
Because it's, I don't have complete confidence that that restraint is locked in.
Yes, that it's 100% foolproof.
Yeah, no, it's not 100% foolproof. And there is increasingly the rhetoric coming out of certain think tanks in the United States that they should act precipitively, that they should get in before Kim Jong-un finalizes his ability to combine that miniaturized weapons and long-range ballistic missile capability, which is, as I say, 2 to 4 years away. So do you act now in to circumvent that from materializing?
Yeah, the bigger atrocity. Head off the bigger atrocity.
Head off the bigger atrocity, but risk an absolute catastrophe striking South Korea.
Yeah, no doubt.
And this is something clearly the South Koreans would, you know, are very, very vocal in arguing against.
Yes, for obvious reasons.
Compelling reasons. Yes. And it looks that, you know, the lead candidate for the upcoming presidential elections in the Republic of Korea and South Korea, Moon Jae-in, is likely to be conciliatory towards Kim Jong-un and the North Korean government, and also less inclined to support the deployment, the continued deployment of the THAADs, the terminal high altitude air defense missile, ballistic missile defense system that the Americans have been installing at the behest of the Park government, which has just been sidelined.
Yes, given shown the back door or
so
the front door.
There is some internal imperatives for action sooner than later on the American side, but there are no easy buttons to press. Unlike even if you can say that they were easy in Syria or Libya, they were relatively safer options than ones that potentially.
Well, the consequences are sort of quarantined, aren't they? I mean, the consequences of those strikes are quarantined, whereas this is a genuine
potentially not quarantined at all.
No, well, quite the I don't know what the opposite of quarantine is, but I would say this would be the opposite of it.
Yeah.
Now, the flip side of the question I asked you, which is in what universe, or is there a universe in which Donald Trump thinks a preemptive strike is a good idea? Let's look at that same question from the North Korean perspective. So if the North Koreans think that there's a universe in which a preemptive strike is a good idea, again, what is that? Where does that leave us?
See, I'm not sure that that is the case. I think they realise... I'm fairly confident they realise that a preemptive strike would generate such a strong reaction that it could possibly see the North Korean state implode. And Kim Jong-un must have a sense of his vulnerability and the lack of support, even from China. The rhetoric from China is surprisingly strident, more strident than I recall ever seeing.
Yeah, well, let's get into China, because obviously they are the most significant player in this whole equation by a considerable margin. So what's China's interests in this, John?
Well, China has an interest in containing and pushing back American military power in East Asia. And they've been pretty good at it in the last few years with their construction of artificial islands in the South China Sea and in applying continued, slowly ratcheted up pressure over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands that are controlled by Japan at the moment, an American ally that the United States has been involved in, over Taiwan and the ratcheting up the pressure there. The United States wouldn't be nearly as comfortable about running an aircraft carrier strike group through the Taiwan Straits as they were a decade ago, because the capability balance is very, very different to what it was back then.
Yeah.
So the United States is demonstrably more constrained in its options than it was, and China's happy about that. And China is on a trajectory to keep pushing for the United States to be unable to operate freely inside the so-called first island chain. That is a goal. That's pretty clear. Most pundits understand that and recognise that. What we see in the Korean Peninsula, however, is the possibility of, if a North Korean state implodes, a reunification of Korea akin to what we saw with the East and West German states after the end of the Cold War.
Yeah, which is not in China's interests, obviously.
Which is definitely not in China's interests, because that would be seeing an American-allied South Korean state bringing its forces, possibly with American forces, up to the Yalu River. And that is just intolerable for China. That would be completely intolerable. So China recognises that that is a realistic prospect, and they also recognise that North Korea is very, very difficult, more difficult to deal with arguably today than it's ever been before. Let's not forget one of the key interlocutors that North Korea had with China, Kim Jong-un's uncle, was assassinated. And so this has, upset the dynamics between China mm-hmm. and North Korea. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese are now, even though most of North Korea's trade passes through China, and it's been an enduring perceived interest for China to keep North Korea as a buffer state, as this kind of twilight zone between American forces in South Korea and mainland China, the rationale for that is diminished. And the relative importance economically of South Korea has grown exponentially. So South Korea is actually far more important to China than it ever was.
Yeah.
And yet we've seen China behave towards South Korea until quite recently in a quite belligerent manner economically, applying sanctions on Korean companies. You know, when we know that a lot of it has to do with the fact that the Koreans are afraid of North Korea.
Mm.
And the deployment of the THAADs is a direct consequence of that fear.
Yeah.
So China has some options. They're just not nice options for China.
Mm-hmm.
They involve applying pressure that China's never felt it had to on North Korea.
Yes.
And cutting off of trade opportunities that it's never been perceived as being in China's interests to
do
pursue.
That. Yes, and do they control the oil supply into North Korea as well, the
largely,
Chinese?
Yes.
So that's another tap.
Yeah, so there's a lot they could do, but they're afraid of the consequences,
yes.
Understandably fearful of the consequences of ratcheting up that pressure too much further.
But you said, I think, before I sort of said let's get into China, that the face-off looked promising. What are they doing now, and how do we interpret that?
China is ratcheting up the pressure. I think there's some pretty strong evidence of that. Even though China's dealings with North Korea are quite opaque, we don't have great visibility on how they operate and the extent to which they're doing what they say they do. One of the problems with monitoring this is that the arrangements have been quite difficult to get visibility on, and China has been very comfortable about keeping it quite opaque. And so while China says it's doing something, many in the West aren't confident that it's actually
that
can be verifiable.
Yes, that it is actually happening.
Yeah, and that mm-hmm. then and that the North Koreans are actually feeling the pressure, and whether or not it's more intended to placate the United States.
Yes, than having an actual
actually substantively
impact.
Changing
yeah,
the equation.
Sure. Mm. And what about Donald Trump? Because of course Trump came into office sort of styling China as, well, I mean, I hate to use North Korean language, but as the number one enemy of the administration. There was this sort of posturing of a face-off, obviously, between America and China over a range of interests, both security and economic.
Yeah.
Has Donald Trump, in your view, got the diplomatic dexterity now to reposition, change course, have a more nuanced approach with China or not?
You know, many people have been critical of Donald Trump's kind of superficial and two-dimensional explanations for complex three-dimensional problems in international relations.
That's a very polite way of putting that.
The thing is, though, that while he has been a bit of a reductionist in that sense, we've seen a surprising concession to nuance and the complexity of the real world
mm-hmm.
in his pronouncements
mm-hmm.
since then.
Mm-hmm.
And those apparently vertigo-inducing policy backflips that he's come up with on China and Russia and a host of other issues are on one level disconcerting because of the extraordinary degree of change.
Yes.
but on another, quite heartening.
Well, yes, reassuring.
Heartening
really.
That he's actually listening to sound policy advice from professionals, from experienced, you know, seasoned international policymakers. So, you know, we still are living in a world only 100 days into the Trump administration where we don't have confidence in exactly what we're seeing and exactly the trajectory that the government in Washington is taking. Still very uncertain. And well, this is part of the problem when you're dealing with this, the extraordinary level of uncertainty about what Trump will do next.
Yes.
Given the backflip over China and Russia and Syria.
Mm.
What's next
yes.
for Korea?
Well, who could possibly predict it is really the problem, which mm. sort of makes renders this podcast somewhat redundant. But we are digging on productively anyway, despite the redundancy of our exercise, trying to predict two of the most unpredictable people in the world.
Well, put yourself in Kim Jong-un's shoes, as odious as they are.
Yes.
How do you read Washington?
Well, exactly. From his perspective, this is extraordinarily difficult. It's sort of at one stage in this very complicated relationship, reading Washington wouldn't be the difficulty.
No, it should. Yes. You would have thought traditionally that's been pretty clear cut.
Yes, yes.
And the North Koreans have for a long time had great confidence that the United States didn't want to cross the red line, if you like, the threshold, the nuclear threshold, or triggering or precipitating a return to the Korean War.
Yeah.
They didn't want to undo the armistice of 1953. I don't know that Kim Jong-un's that confident about that anymore.
No, exactly, which is sort
and
of, yes.
I don't think most of us are either.
No, yes. Look, that's a very cheery note, but let's just wrap with Australia and Australia's influence, if any, in such a complicated geopolitical play. Where does Australia line up? Obviously, we've seen what the Prime Minister has said publicly about China must do X, Y, and Z, and that's what you'd expect an Australian government to say. But look, in the real world, do we have any influence? And if we do, how should we exercise it?
Yeah, I think Australia has, on East Asian affairs, more influence than we realise. We are very heavily invested. We're very well plugged in, and we're quite closely and intimately integrated in with the Department of State, with the Pentagon, with the White House. In a way, most pundits don't quite appreciate. Australia has, this is one of the spin-offs of our post 9/11 tango with the United States.
Well, I was going to say obsequience, but that's possibly a bit rude.
Well, my sense is that it's actually a calculated approach from a view of what Australia's national interests are.
Of course.
That are conservative.
I'm being flippant.
Yeah. But I think they're driven by that calculus that are very much informed by, you know, one number that I tell my students all the time that jumps out for Australian policymakers, 1942. And much of what we do in the national security and international relations space is driven by the fear of a repeat of that terrible year when Darwin was bombed, Sydney was bombed, and Australia's troops were captured in Singapore and pushed back almost to Port Moresby in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, and the year Australia's place in the world fundamentally changed.
Fundamentally altered, exactly right. Now, that thinking and the significance of the United States to Australia's freedom and prosperity has permeated strategic consciousness ever since. Of course, the world's now no longer as it was when the Cold War ended. It's more complicated. It's the role of the United States is one that we've assumed was going to be about pursuing interests very congruent with Australia's interests by and large around the world, in security ways especially. There is growing angst about an apparent divergence of interests and of the United States. While, you know, we have long looked to the United States in a way, interesting, and I write about relations with Canada, the contrast with Canada, a country very, very similar to Australia in many ways, is that Canadians talk about defense against help. They have a defense force. They exercise that capability so that the Americans won't do it for them, to keep them at bay.
Yeah, right.
For us, there's an opposite imperative. We have, for the last 70 years, operated in such a way to make the Americans not forget us and feel obliged to us.
Obliged to us, yeah.
Well, the question now is, how much do we really want to keep that up?
Mm.
Do we want to follow them
into any adventure?
An adventure in the South China Sea or the Taiwan Straits or the Korean Peninsula?
Mm.
These are not implausible scenarios.
No, of course.
That policymakers and planners need to think through. And we in Australia need to be continuing to have a conversation about.
Yeah, exactly. And we do the sort of, there's always a formulation which is sort of more put in more binary and crude terms in a foreign policy sense, that Australia at some point will have to choose between China and America. But it's actually much more complicated than
that. It is more complicated. I agree.
Yes. Yeah. And maybe some choices will be thrust upon us.
Well, we at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre pulled together a book last year called Australia's American Alliance. It came out just after Trump was elected, but it spoke to a number of the issues that resonate very much since Trump has become president. One of the things about that book, and I commend it to your listeners, Australia's American Alliance, is it demonstrates the extraordinary breadth and depth of the relationship with the United States that has gone way beyond the words of ANZUS of 1951. The relationship now is so broad and so extensive and so deep. We are so intimately connected on so many levels with the United States. That works for us, but it presents some risks as well. It works for us in the way I mentioned before about the access. When Australians turn up to Washington, American policymakers sit up and listen.
Mm, mm.
And that's heartening.
Yes.
And it's quite genuine.
Yeah, sure. And you would prefer to be in that position than the alternative.
That is the return on the long investment.
Exactly. But then the question that you're posing is whether or not that intimacy and that interoperability, for want of a better word, is something that we want to fully subscribe to in a complicated world.
We have another book coming out shortly by one of our former students, Shannon Tao, called Independent Ally. And it's coming out with MUP shortly. And it's a cracker, and it talks about this challenge for Australia. You know, we've invested in this relationship, and it explores how much freedom of action we still have.
Mm.
And Shannon's point is essentially, well, we still have choices. We can exercise those choices. The question is, do we have the political will?
Well, exactly, to exercise our own agency.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, we could actually talk about this for hours, but we probably should ground the aircraft at this time. having walked around that reasonably comprehensively, we're very, very grateful for your time.
My pleasure, Catherine. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you, everyone, so much for listening. We really do appreciate it. You can find additional podcasts that are produced by Guardian Australia by searching for them in the same way that you search for us, either on iTunes or your favourite podcast app. That would be app with a double P, or on Spotify, which I gather Australian Politics Live is now also on Spotify. Thank you to the wonderful, marvellous Miles Martignoni, who is the producer of this podcast. We are very grateful for his efforts as always. As I said at the top of the pod, there's another instalment coming up shortly, which will focus on the first 100 days of Donald Trump. Just keep your eye out for that.